Welcome to the Calder Farmstead, your place for news, analysis, and shenanigans from the American Hockey League.
Hello, hello, hello from Felkirch, Austria.
And Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, episode 133 for March 24th, 2023. That's a Friday. Thank you. If you were hoping for a podcast featuring advice on spring seedlings, we are not going to be much help. This is an American Hockey League podcast. My name is Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And I'm Sarah Avampato from Full Press Hockey and SB Nation's Canes Country.
And as always, we thank you for tuning in with us. And if you're new to hearing Sarah and I talk about hockey, we're going to talk about, well, eight teams around the AHL and dive in and see what's going on with them, because there's not really any league news going on. We both watch a lot of AHL games. We're going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break it down. If that's new to you, you may want to head over to our podcast feed or YouTube channel, wherever you're checking us out from, and check out episode zero. It's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're new to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer advanced hockey terms like controlled zone entries or Royal Road, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes. And let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes thinking the Chicago Blackhawks had turned a corner. You'll never get that time back. So next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey? Sarah, as far as I'm aware, there is no league-wide news to really dive in and discuss. Not much happening going around the league as a whole. Teams have a lot going on, but there's no like big league. There's no trades or relocations or
I hope not.
Yeah. Trades at this point would seem unacceptable, but...
Yeah, there's rules.
Anyway, let's go right in. Sarah, as always, we start Atlantic to Pacific, east to west. Where are we going?
We are starting in Chocolate Town. We're going to Hershey, where the Hershey Bears have made a return to form this season after a bit of a disappointing one last season. While rosters in the AHL year to year do change a lot, and the Bears were no different, the biggest change seemed to be at the top, with Todd Nelson taking over for Scott Allen. So what have you seen as differences between the two teams in how they play and perform?
So this is probably going to be our most ambitious breakdown we've ever done, because it's not just how one team plays and why it's working for them, which is what we'll do later in the episode for Cleveland and their penalty kill. And we've done countless other times in the show for teams all over the AHL with all kinds of different things, whether it be power play, 5-on-5, etc. This is different in that it compares two teams to each other and why one playing one way is working better than one playing the other way, with the catch being it's the same team a year apart under different coaches. And that allowed us to kind of dive into how systems play brings out the best or worst in players, as well as how chemistry and stuff like that all kind of enter the equation. But that's what happens when you try and draw conclusions before you dive in and do the work. You end up surprised when things don't fall into your kind of preconceived notions about how stuff works. I, when I started thinking about doing this, was pretty convinced from watching the Bears this season that Nelson had them doing a lot of things different and more efficiently on the ice, and that's why the Bears are having a better year despite not getting the best goaltending. Like, Shepard's been good, but not great. Fucali's been a guy. But spoiler here for the whole thing, there's like one difference in systems, and it's more of a adding an element than anything else. And I think it matters, but it's not the only factor in play here. A lot of the on-ice tactics here that we're going to talk about are the same. And let's start from a statistical perspective here. Hershey stats from last year to this year shows not a lot of changes. In 21-22, they took 30.46 shots on goal per game in regulation. That was 11th in the AHL. They allowed 26.37 in regulation. That was 4th in the AHL on a per game basis. They averaged 2.51 goals for, 2.62 goals against per game. That was 30th and 4th, respectively. In 2023, so far, they're 28.17 in shots and goal per game. That's 28th in the AHL. And 25.20 allowed per game in regulation. That's the best in the AHL. In terms of goals, they're 2.85 for and 2.43 against. That's 25th best and first best in terms of goals for and against. And that just sounds like a wall of numbers to you. Let me make it easy. Hershey's improved from a league-wide perspective in shots against and goals against, but not by a ton. And offensively, they're shooting less but scoring more. And while the numbers don't shift a ton, that shift takes them from being a team with a negative goal differential, albeit slightly, to one with a positive goal differential. And that shift definitely matters. And my first thought is, well, this is probably a special teams thing. Perhaps, you know, Todd Nelson's Bears are doing better on special teams, and that's what's making up some of this gap in shots and goals, because we don't have numbers that are strictly power play or even strength. We try to do our best with them to make them kind of work, but we don't have those numbers from the AHL. They're not publicly available, which is silly, but that's another time. But to my great surprise, Hershey's special team numbers from last year and where they are to today, the Thursday the 23rd, as we record tonight, they are identical. Hershey's power play in 21-22 was 17.4%. It ranked 26 in the AHL. Their penalty kill in 21-22 was 81.6%. It ranked 12th. This year so far, their power play is 17.4%, ranking 26th in the AHL, and 81.6% on the penalty kill, ranking 13th. I literally double-checked this several times because I genuinely couldn't believe that. It's not like they were kind of close, but they were the exact same percentages for both teams in both seasons. So that shot down my, this is a special teams thing that's different between Nelson's Bears and Allen's Bears, because even if they were doing different things, they're not causing different results. So my second thought was something different and something systematic at even strength. Nelson's Bears are doing something different 5-on-5 strategically in places than Allen's Bears. That's suppressing shots better, but keeping their own offensive opportunities down, and that gap is being filled by more efficient chances being created and players on the roster fitting better into what Nelson is doing compared to what Scott Allen was doing. And there's really only one change that Nelson's Bears have made from a systems perspective. It's more of a wrinkle than something completely different. And we'll get into that. But first, I think it's important to highlight that a lot of stuff is still the same. And for that, unfortunately, I'm going to have to kick Sarah out, and we're going to go to the video room, just the two of us. So we'll be back in a little bit, Sarah.
Bye, have fun.
And here we are. We've kicked Sarah out, unfortunately, as the bandwidth does not like to keep her in for this. So it's just me, you, and some video. If you are normally a podcast listener, this would be a great time to head over to our YouTube channel to check this out. Otherwise, this isn't going to make a bunch of sense because I'm going to be talking about video we're looking at. So head over to our YouTube channel. Just go over to YouTube and search The Calder Farmstead. You will find us. You already know the name of the episode and all that kind of thing. So I will make sure that those are timestamped so you can come right to the Bears part and not have to re-listen to a whole bunch. So all that being said, let's talk about how the Bears systems that they're playing this year are the same as the ones they played last year. So Nelson and Allen's systems aren't terribly different. In many cases, they're carbon copies of each other. And we're not going to go through every single instance because, well, we all have lives to get to, and we don't. I think one or two will make everyone understand here that a lot of things are same. So we're going to focus on three big ones here: breakout, defensive zone play, and offensive zone play. We're not going to cover forechecking. They're the same. We're not going to cover regroups. Those are the same. Special teams are a little bit different, but as we talked about, having the same effect as they are at the exact same percentages, some crazy how. So let's get right into it. Let's talk about breakouts. For reference, all of the times in which the Bears are in white is from last season. All the times in which they're in chocolate are from this season. I figured that was a nice, easy distinction so that everyone can kind of keep track as we're going along. But let's hit play here and get to it. So the Bears are going to field this dump in. And what you're going to see is you're going to see under pressure here, this dump is going to get fielded and it's going to be carried around and trying to make a play to a winger who's going to be over here off screen on the boards. We're already seeing Garrett Pilon come in. Pilon's going to read this and he's going to take a turn and he's going to hug what's known as the dot lane. Basically, it's an invisible line. If you drew a line through all of the face-off dots on one side. So basically you're cutting the ice into thirds, left, center, and right. And he's going to hug that dot lane and kind of go up and skate up it. Axel Janssen-Fjällby, who's not on the screen yet, is going to do a similar route, but he's going to pivot and go wider here. So let's roll the tape here. So we see under pressure here, this defenseman makes the play up the boards. Why am I white now? I don't want to be white. Makes the play up the boards to this winger. And we saw Garrett Pilon kind of make this route hugging the dot lane. We saw Axel Janssen-Fjällby make this route kind of hugging around. And basically this winger here has a choice. If he gets pressured immediately, he has quick outlet access right to Pilon. If this winger kind of defends the lane between him and Pilon, he can let those two fly by, and then he should have an easy passing lane across here to Axel Janssen-Fjällby for a zone exit. He gets pressured immediately, and what that means is he's just going to make this quick touch pass right to Garrett Pilon. Pilon catches it. They're out in the neutral zone, 2-on-2, controlled zone exit. That's what you want. You want to leave the zone with possession. So, fast forward to this year. Again, we're going to see the beginnings of a similar breakout happening, and then the Bears are going to feel pressure, and they're going to reverse it going the other way, but you're going to see the exact same concepts that we just talked about. A player anchoring on the far boards, two forwards, kind of just making one route that goes right along the dot lane and another that goes a little wider to give them some layers. So the Bears field this puck here, and what we saw in the last video is what we're starting to see the beginnings of here. This pass around the boards being made. This winger, who I believe is Beck Malenstein, is sitting here along the boards looking to make that pass. You see these two forwards starting their routes that are going to come like this. But the Bears feel pressure and they decide, all right, we have to send this puck going the other way. So instead, this forward becomes the board side guy on this side. He's going to go pick up this puck. This forward's going to make that exact same route, but on this side, he's going to swing right around this dot lane as short support. This forward over here is going to make this bigger, wider swing, and they're going to leave in the exact same manner they did in the previous video from last season, that two on two into the neutral zone. So this forward smartly looks over his shoulder. He sees this guy coming. It's like, all right, I have to make this quick bump pass here, which we saw kind of in the last video too. Makes this quick touch. He guards, he skates right up this dot lane, and they're going to leave the zone 2-on-2 in a controlled fashion, which is exactly what you want. So as you can see here, not a lot is changing on breakouts from year to year under Allen and Nelson. So let's look at defensive zone play. The Bears in the defensive zone have two separate schemes that they play. One when the puck is below the hash marks or below the faceoff dots, and one when it is above the faceoff dots or the hash marks. And the hash marks, I just mean these faceoff hash marks that you see here that go right along the faceoff dots that are on either side of the boards. That's all we're talking about here. All right, so Rochester is kind of recovering a dump in here. We're going to let this play a little bit so play kind of gets settled. All right, So Puck is going to get shot here. Bears don't really recover, but the Bears are now finally starting to settle into their defensive zone structure, transitioning from what is basically rush defense preparing to break out from a dump in. So what we're going to see here is the puck is above the dots. The Bears play man-to-man coverage, and they're in pretty good position for that already. These two here, you know, right next to each other. This forward's identified his check. This forward's identified his check. This guy has a defenseman that's off the screen here a little bit. The only one who's kind of not necessarily right on top of their guy or following them closely is this Bears player right here. And we're going to see him recognize that and him look over his shoulder and try and figure out who his guy is and where it's supposed to be. So as we can see him making some head moves here, looking over his shoulder, where's my guy? Where's my guy? Realizes it and starts backing towards him. Whereas player on his check, guys off screen are doing their job. Unfortunately, what we're seeing here is one of the downsides of playing man-to-man, and that's if the guy with the puck or even someone off puck gets past their guy, we now have a little miniature 5-on-4, and that causes other players to kind of have to decide, okay, do I now leave my assignment here to come out and pressure, or do I let him kind of walk in and hope that he doesn't do anything bad? That's where you see a lot of breakdowns in man-to-man coverage, is when one guy gets beat by his check. And now what we're seeing is the puck being below the dots, and the Bears play what's called a five tight below the dots. And what they're looking to do here is collapse all of their defenders, all five of them, into basically, you know, this general area, where they're trying to outnumber the offense down low. And every guy has their own kind of responsibility here. One player will be directly on the puck carrier. One defender will defend the net front. One will kind of try and outman when he can, as well as cover any other outlets. The winger here in this will come down and cover the slot, as well as make sure that he's cutting off this passing lane to the top. This other winger will do basically the same thing and defend this dot lane and make sure that passes don't get through to the top. As play continues to kind of carry on here, we can still see puck below the dot lane. You're going to see this Bears forward who fell come back into the screen, as well as this Bears forward who was in man-to-man very briefly come back down into the screen. There he is. And you'd see they're not playing man-to-man here anymore. This is not man-to-man coverage with all of that gap. This player right here is actively leaving his man to recover and cover this space, this passing lane, instead of a specific person. And again, the Bears are pressuring down here. They're looking to try and outnumber the offense in the low area here, which they are doing. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them to 1, 2, 3 to three Rochester offensive players. Unfortunately, Rochester's doing a good job of changing sides, which forces the Bears to change responsibilities here, as well as doing a good job of keeping the puck moving without having to face too much pressure at any individual level. That does make it hard, especially when you're balancing between man-to-man coverage and what is basically a zone coverage and shifting responsibilities. But the Bears do a decent job here of keeping play to the outside and from the threatening areas, which is the whole point. So again, we're seeing play start to go up the wall here, and this is where it shifts from being man-to-man to zone. And you can see this shift from man-to-man to zone. You could see 22 here was covering kind of this area, and as soon as this puck comes up high, he's not going to attack the puck carrier. He's going to make sure he latches onto his check that's coming down the boards here. Unfortunately, again, as we said with man-to-man coverage, all it takes is for one guy to, you know, fall down, lose an edge, or get beat by the puck carrier, and then we have this miniature 5-on-4 for, you know, a little brief period of time, and that's what causes defensive breakdowns, because now this guy has to decide, do I keep skating with my check, or do I try and attack the puck carrier and pressure him? Thankfully, it doesn't matter too long, as I believe that's Eddie Wickow gets up, gets back in the play. We have a little bit of a scramble here. The Bears recover. They don't quite get rid of the puck, unfortunately. And again, we see some line changes have happened here, but we're still seeing the same man-to-man concept as the puck is coming above the dots. Puck is going low again, and again, we'll see this winger come crashing in here to defend this area. You have this other forward here who's defending this area. The Bears are finally at a point where they can outnumber play a 2-on-1 down low and try and force the turnover with the zone defense they're playing. It doesn't quite work out for them, unfortunately. Puck goes high again, and we shift back to man-to-man. You see them come crashing down, collapsing again, but they're able to finally force a bad pass and get the puck out. Now, that was last season and trying to demonstrate through a longer possession, man-to-man coverage, as well as the five tight. So here is this season's team playing Providence from not that long ago. And here you have, again, puck in the corner. You have five tight. So we want five Bears in the picture. One, two, three, four, five, all trying to cut and outnumber the offense in this area and force turnovers to end the cycle. So the Providence gets a change of side. We'll see this guy come over to defend this area again in this passing lane. This winger come over to defend the slot. We'll see both of these guys come over to defend their responsibility in their areas that we talked about already. Providence looks again to change sides. And again, we see his responsibility goes from defending this slot area to cutting the top and cutting this passing lane. His area goes from defending this dot lane and this passing lane to defending the slot. And they do a good job this time of defending the slot and cutting the top off so the passes can't get through, because they intercept the pass and walk it out. Now, another game from this season, we're going to see man-to-man coverage here as the puck goes above the dots. We're going to see is man-to-man here, and you're going to see guys transition from playing that tight zone defense to playing man-to-man. So as this puck comes up, you're going to see them identify their checks here. Identifies his check. And unfortunately, this guy, I believe, is Beck Mallinson here. He's going to get clipped going by and fall. But you also can see here how quickly guys are adapting and making moves. So, guy on his check. This should be Beck Malenstein's guy, and he probably would have gotten there should he not gotten to, accidentally tripped here. This guy is without a dance partner, and you'll see he immediately starts to look around and then identifies who's his guy and makes a beeline over to this Rochester player. So, Beck recovers here. Goes to pressure his guy, but again, man-to-man. And you can see he's closing the distance. He knows where his guy is. He's going to get there. Bears recover the shot and make the zone exit here. So as we can see, not a lot is changing in the defensive zone. This is, a pretty similar concept from year to year. So now it's time to turn the page and look to the offense. And the Bears offense plays a pretty simple style. It's called a 2-1-2. And basically what they're looking to do is make a triangle with the forwards, where the puck carrier who's along the boards or in the corner, who's working the cycle, has support either up boards or down boards, an easy kind of chip pass he can make under pressure, as well as if he gets a chance to make a better play, having someone in a scoring area that can be a threat to score. So puck gets dumped in. Bears are going to recover this puck right about here, and already perfectly positioned for the offense they're trying to set up. They have this guy who's going to be the puck carrier, some downboard support, and a guy in a scoring position. This is your 1-2-1-1-2. 2-1-2. It's not named for anything terribly clever or creative. I'm sorry, guys. So downboard support, guy in scoring position. They make this kind of triangle. Phil Jackson would be so proud. And if they aren't able to, you know, make these continuation pass down below to continue the cycle, they do work the puck, obviously, up to the point. And when they do work the puck up to the point, what you'll see is you'll see this forward who's kind of was low board support come to the net front. This guy immediately peel off and go back to try and crash the net. This forward will push the puck up the boards to the point, and then he will reload up here. So in case a block shot happens, he's able to get back on defense. And once he realizes everything's okay and it's safe, he'll come crashing back down in as a second wave of offense. So as you can see, puck gets to the point. This guy immediately is like, all right, it's time to go back to the net here to crash for tips and rebounds. Doesn't have the most successful time getting there as this Wilkes-Barre Scranton defender kind of holds him up a little bit in a legal manner, but still, you know, kind of blocks him getting there. You see this forward load up and this guy take the shot. Fortunately, rebound doesn't go the Bears' way. The Penguins recover. It goes out of the zone. Now, this is the Bears this season. Again, we're going to see a lot of the same kind of play here. So, puck goes down. They recover and immediately are getting into position for their 2-1-2. So, the player who kind of just chipped this puck back up the wall here to his upboard support. As you can see, two guys are behind the net here, but this one is going to come out and just pop right out to be part of that triangle. So where he's skating to is about right here, and that's going to give him downboard support, guy with puck, triangle. Right there. One, two, three. And again, you'll see the Bears, you know, not able to make it happen down low. They get into a bit of a board battle. They kick the puck up high. Now, what you're going to see here is you're going to see as the puck goes high, this forward reloads up and then comes crashing down. These two guys immediately turn and make beelines for the net. Unfortunately, the Bears don't score on the shot. They don't get the rebound. Lehigh Valley recovers. Puck goes the other way. But as you can see, same system, same concepts year to year in all these places. But, and here's the big one, the Bears this year have added some wrinkles to that system. And we're going to talk about them here that weren't present last year. One of the things they're starting to do now is if they have space between the defender and the blue, between the guy who's playing defense against them and their defense on the blue, like their defenseman on the blue line, they'll start to do this handoff activation where they would normally work the puck up and this guy would reload into the offense. But what we're seeing here is this Bears defenseman being told to activate off the blue line and take basically a drop pass here. And then he's going to walk around and look to attack this passing lane, because what that should give this handoff here is space. What's going to happen here is you're going to have a moment where he's able to separate from his check here, and there's going to be vacated passing lane right here that they're trying to hit a backdoor play on. It's not always successful, but the Bears are starting to do this a lot this season, and it didn't happen last season. So as we can see, drop pass, this opens up this passing lane as these two can't exactly communicate that handoff defensively. And you're going to see a play here to the backdoor cutting through this passing lane. You can see big passing lane here to the back door. Fortunately, Bears can't quite bury it, but a very good scoring chance. The other part of this activation that's different this year from last year that we'll see is this part. So Bears work the puck up the wall, something we saw previously. This forward is still going to reload up the wall here, but the Bears, instead of just firing the shot into, you know, two guys who are crashing the net here, they're going to see activation from this weak side and basically rotate this way. So play still. This four who's going to come back into the picture is going to activate up here. But this guy, this is Aaron Ness, is going to activate into this space and kind of force this defender into a bad place where he's not sure if he's supposed to cover this defenseman or if he's supposed to cover the slot, because they're in kind of an awkward transition between defending high areas and defending low ones. And this is the area they're looking to attack. We talk about attacking across Royal Road. Royal Road is this imaginary line that if we divide the offensive zone in half, hot dog style, you're able to passes that go shots off of passes across Royal Road within a second. So this pass gets made and the shot goes on the net. That means you've got the goalie moving laterally to a place he can't see out of his peripheral vision likely. And that's going to increase your chances of scoring. And that's what the Bears are trying to do here, is they're activating this weak side player, forcing this defender to kind of choose between defending him or defending the slot. And that opens up a passing lane to a high danger area or high danger chance. They're going to try and make this pass here right to Aaron Ness on his forehand so he can walk in and shoot. Unfortunately, the pass doesn't go exactly on his tape. He has to catch it awkwardly on his backhand and can't make the play he wanted, but you can see the concept they're going for here. Those plays didn't happen in Scott Allen's Bears. They happened during Todd Nelson's time, and that's something that he has added to the offense. It's a wrinkle, it's a play inside the same structure, but everything else is mostly the same as we showed you. So the conclusion that I'm drawing is that the Bears go from finishing 22nd in the AHL last season with a 34-42 record to fifth in the AHL so far this season with a 37-23 record based on deactivations in the offensive zone. Well, not entirely. That's part of it, but Nelson's Bears have one other big advantage. Let's start with the health of the roster. I know this is a point we beat to death last season when talking about Hershey, but I think there are some numbers that will surprise people here. So this year we started, part of the graphs and stuff that I do is tracking man games lost from the starting weekend lineup. And that's not a perfect measure of, you know, injuries and health and call-ups and how they affect a team, but I think it's at least a decent one. Basically it's saying, all right, this your opening weekend lineup, you know, the 18, 19, 20 players you had, those were the guys you were at least expecting to spend the season on your roster. They were there opening night. I think it's reasonable to think those guys would be there. Now, obviously, some of them would get hurt. Some of them would get called up, etc. But subtracting that from how many games they actually played from the number they maximally could have played, I think gives you at least some indication of health and call-ups as a problem. The 2021-22 Bears lost 491 combined games from their starting weekend lineup. Sarah, would you like to take a guess at how many through 62 games, I think it is, through today, that the 2022-23 Bears currently have lost from their starting weekend roster?
I'm going to go, 491 is ridiculous. So, and I know that I'm not watching Bears games and being like, wow, there sure is no one here. So we're going to go with, 300-something.
245. That is almost exactly half. To put that into perspective this year, Toronto is currently leading the league in man games lost at 528. It's a 491 is a lot. Currently, and there's only 15 games left, no one else is over 491. Laval is close at 481. Colorado and a couple others are in the 400s. No one else is where Toronto is. But yeah, 491 is a lot. And nine players from the roster in 21-22's opening weekend were on the Bears' 22-23 opening weekend roster. That's Johansson, Gersich, Malenstein, Pilon, Vecchione, Kessie, Scarbosa, McElrath, and Fucali. But this year's Bears also added important pieces like Sam Annis, Vincent Liorio, Aaron Ness, Henrik Borgstrom, Gabriel Carlson, Hendrix Lapierre, as well as more games from Connor McMichael and a lot more games from their second leading goal scorer, Ethan Frank. yeah, they lost Matt Molson, Brian Pinno, Axel Janssen Fjällby, and Cody Franzen, but the Bears come out way ahead in this exchange of last year's rosters and talent to this year's rosters and talent, especially because this year's roster don't have to drag along guys like Drake Rieschma or Marcus Vila or Christopher Brown up and down the ice this season. The worst player Hershey's regularly played this season is Matthew Strome, which, yeah, Matthew Strome's not great, but he's still a clear AHL-level talent. Not a great one, but still one. If Matthew Strome is the worst player your team ices regularly, you're doing okay. Here's the other big thing, too, is this year's team compared to last year's has a big difference in puck luck. Estimated PDO for Hershey for the entirety of last season is 98.65, which is unlucky, but not, like, horrifically so. It's not great, but this season they're at 101.29. Again, that's not super lucky, but it is above average, and that 3.5 point swing matters. So what I'm saying here is the big difference between Nelson's Bears and Allen's Bears, yeah, the systems are very similar, but I think the activating D in the ozone can break down defensive systems and create more quality chances, which does show up in the stats that they're taking fewer shots but having more success. Talent is also better this year, and puck luck is better this year. And those things together, I think, are what fills the bridge between a team that underachieved last year and a team that is back to where Hershey thinks it should be, or is used to being, I'll say. And those, only one of those does Todd Nelson really control, and that's the systems part of it. Mm-hmm. But Sarah, I think that is plenty for Hershey. That was a lot of video that we talked about, or, well, I guess I talked about. You weren't allowed to make the trip, unfortunately.
No, I was exiled.
Bandwidth exiled us from that. But I think that's a good place to leave it for Hershey. Let's move on. Let's talk about the Hartford Wolfpack. Hartford was one of the more active teams at the trade deadline as the organization tries to improve the team's chances of making the playoffs for the first time since the 14-15 season, as well as, you know, making some moves in those playoffs. The Wolfpack are currently seventh in the Atlantic Division with a 44.1% chance of making the playoffs. Sarah, how have the new additions been helpful to Hartford, and do you think it's enough to get them in the postseason?
All right, so if you missed our past couple weeks where we talked trade deadline and went over each team's acquisitions, Hartford did make a lot of moves. They added Adam Clendenning, Anton Bleed, Wyatt Kalinuk, Will Lockwood, and Cooper Zeck, all in different trades. And so looking at what each of those guys have contributed since coming over, Clendenning has 6 assists in 9 games. He's getting some power play time. Bleed has 3 goals and 1 assist over 7 games. Kalinuk has no points in 5 games. Lockwood's 1 goal, 3 assists over 6 games. And Cooper Zeck was basically immediately assigned to the ECHL, so he like no longer counts here. So we're not necessarily seeing major contributions from the new guys. But in fairness to them, none of them were exactly projected to be guys who were going to suddenly jump to the top of the score sheet for Hartford. The fact that Bleed has 4 points in 7 games is honestly maybe the most impressive of the bunch. Like, that is not, I think we kind of looked at him and is like, you're going to be just a grinder, big body kind of guy. Like, great, cool. He had 6 goals over 36 games when he was with Colorado. He's got 3 in 7. So, you know, that's even for me not being a great person with math, that's a significant improvement in terms of the pace. Right now, he's at a 0.57 points per goal pace or points per game pace here. He was 0.33 in Colorado. Other than that, everyone else is basically kind of a giant shrug. They didn't go out and acquire Rocco Grimaldi kind of guy. They didn't go out and get an elite defenseman. They got support players so that some of their ECHL call-ups could go back to where they came from, so the guys who were maybe playing a little too high up could be slotted back down in the lineup. And that's what these guys are doing, and that is what they acquired them for. So, you know, great. Probably more importantly than the trade acquisitions for that postseason push for Hartford are the players that the Wolfpack have been getting back from the Rangers. So Johnny Brodzinski, he's been up and down all year, but he's always been impactful when he's been in Hartford's lineup. He has played 6 games in the month of March, and he has 10 points. 3 of those games are multi-point games. He has 2 game-winning goals. Now, if you know me, I have covered the Kings for a long time. I'm understandably a pretty big Johnny Brodzinski fan. I liked him a lot when he was part of the Kings organization, when he was with the Rain. And he was usually a player who stepped up in big moments. So it's not surprising to see him contributing down the stretch for Hartford. Jake Lecision was sent down March 3rd. He was part of the Rangers moving money around for their own trade deadline moves, and was kind of the cap casualty of getting waived. He has 7 points in 9 games, is picking up power play time, is fine here. Ryan Carpenter also is a guy who's been back and forth. He's been a little streakier. He'll have stretches of 3-4 games where he's scoreless, but he still has 5 points in 9 games over the month of March. So when we talk about impact players, you know, we're not talking about Adam Clendenning. No offense to Adam Clendenning. We're talking about these guys who are coming back down from the NHL who are going to be able to make an impact, you know, here with Hartford. They have had kind of a rough go of it lately. They're 4-4-1-1 over their last 10. They've been shut out twice, both times against Springfield. And they've overall been playing in some lopsided games that have gone each way. They won 9-0 over Bridgeport. Then they also turned in a 6-3 loss against Charlotte, 8-4 loss against Rochester. So it's that classic AHL sort of schedule where they win big one night and then lose horrifically the next night. Like that's what they've been turning in a lot lately. A lot is also going to hinge on Louis Domingue as a goaltender. He's pretty much dead average in terms of being a goaltender. He's rated as a backup. His goals saved above average is like 0.025. So he's just, when you look at the chart, he's kind of in the middle. From the eye test, though, and from seeing him throughout his career, he is a guy who has been able to go in and steal a game every so often. So I think that, you know, if he stays healthy, if he keeps starting the majority of the games, it's going to be good for Hartford. But, you know, they're still not 100% in the playoffs. So this is a push that could kind of disintegrate at the end of it all. But for right now, they're at least in a good position.
I have some faith in Hartford to at least, like, they're not going to run, I don't think they run the table to get in. But I think more of where my faith is placed is in Bridgeport to blow it. That is more of where my faith in it's like, I think Hartford's is a good team and a fun team. I do like their fan base a lot. Mm-hmm. They're a lot of fun. But I trust Bridgeport and Brent Thompson to just, like, that is where my faith is.
Get in all however, right, you so can.
Let's move on. Let's go to the North Division, and let's talk about the Toronto Marlies, who decided that last year, after they missed the playoffs, basically by shooting themselves in the foot repeatedly, they were going to go out and get it done this year. They're the only team in the Eastern Conference, as of this recording, to punch their ticket to the playoffs. And they've done it by being far and away the best team in their division. They've got a 16-point lead on second place Syracuse and are projected to end the season with 94 points. Their upward trajectory isn't quite as dramatic as Coachella Valley or Calgary, but no one else in the North has even been close to touching them since Christmas, basically. With their sights set firmly on the playoffs, is there anything that they should be paying attention to in these final weeks of the season?
All right, so if you're a Marlies fan, like, there doesn't seem to be a lot to worry about. No one is catching you. You're just going to watch your team cruise into the playoffs. If I'm part of the Marlies organization, like, I'm sure it has to be kind of hard to keep focus on the here and now, on the games that they're playing right now, today, tomorrow, instead of already looking forward to the future. Like, I don't know that the Marlies suffer from the same affliction as the Maple Leafs do, where they get bounced in the first round, no matter what they do, like, just because of imploding. I don't know that the Marlies are going to suffer that same fate, but I think that they have to be able to make sure that they're staying focused and that they're not getting too far ahead of themselves. Right now they're 25-10-0-1 against their own division. So if you're wondering why they have a 16-point lead on the second place team in their division, that is why, because they have crushed everyone else in their division. If the playoffs started today, right now they would play the winner of the series between Rochester and Belleville. Versus Rochester, they're 4-3-0-1. Versus Belleville, they're 6-2-0. So, you know, I think they'd probably prefer to have to take on Belleville. Where it gets interesting, though, is when we look at what would happen if they get out of their division and make it to the conference final, play a team from the Atlantic. They're 5-4-1-0 against the Atlantic. They haven't played Providence at all. Providence, obviously, the top team over there. They played Hershey once, and they lost 4-3. Hershey and Providence both are much stronger defensively than any of the Marlies competition in their own division. So if we're assuming that one of Hershey or Providence is the team that comes out of the Atlantic, the Marlies are going to be in for kind of a whole new world of discovery of teams that have a little stronger defensive structure than teams in their own division. Even looking at goaltending in Providence, Brandon Bussey, we've talked about him a ton on this show. He's been one of the best goalies in the league this season. Joseph Wall is also one of the top goaltenders, but basically he's the first guy called up the second Toronto needs a goaltender. Just today on Thursday, he was called up on an emergency basis to the Maple Leafs. And this is not the first time that he's been kind of yanked up there. So, you know, a lot is going to depend for them on how frequently Toronto needs to steal him for whatever reason. When you look at their rolling estimated PDO currently, it's 101.46, so a little high, but not crazy. But overall, when you look at that chart, they've been relatively consistent this whole season. We're not seeing these big dramatic leaps that like we have with other teams. They're just sort of, you know, there's been some ups and downs like there have been for any team. Toronto, as we know, is a team that is greatly affected by what happens with the Maple Leafs. So there's obviously some dips when their guys get called up. But this is a team that, like, they kind of are what they are. What we're seeing from them is who they are. One of the things that I think that they need to make sure they focus on is keeping the power play hot. The current power play, net power play, is number one in the league. So they are getting that right, absolutely, this season. There has been a bit of a dry spell lately over the last 10 games. They've only got 5 power play goals on 35 chances. They've also had 3 consecutive losses. And in those 3 losses, they have scored 2 goals total. So, you know, every team has a rough patch. This is no exception. But I think that they need to make sure that doesn't spiral out of control. You know, we talked earlier about the man games lost in Toronto having just like the biggest, like the most man games lost. But, you know, I think that they're in a little bit of a weird position because Toronto did the Toronto thing where they just sent down a bunch of guys on day one to get cap compliant. And then, you know, they weren't guys who were necessarily going to be on the Marlies, but sort of temporarily got to hang out there. So I feel like their big giant red blob is a bit of a like misdirect. But they still have missed a lot of players throughout the year. But for the most part, their top guys are in their lineup. The Leafs have been doing a lot of emergency call-ups lately, so that could at any time impact the Marlies negatively. But overall, I think that if you're a Toronto Marlies fan, if you're part of the team, the goal is to just keep your focus. We have seen good teams get too overconfident and underperform. We've seen it, I don't know, just 10 minutes down the road with the parent club. Of just, you know, imploding for no good reason. Looking at the Marlies' remaining schedule, they've got Cleveland twice, 1 rematch with Hershey, 4 times against Belleville. So, like, that'll be probably some nice stats padding as the season ends. And then once each against Hartford, Utica, and Laval. Hershey's really the only one that I think could give them more trouble, but they're also facing off against a lot of teams who are trying to solidify playoff spots, get better seeding. So there could be some trap games in the Marlies' future. Overall, I like this team. I don't know how deep they can go. We've talked repeatedly about how this division has average at best goaltending, and the Marlies aren't entirely the exception here, especially if Wall spends more time with the Maple Leafs. Fun fact, the AHL considers a goaltender to be qualified if they have played at this point 1,200 minutes. That number obviously increases as the season goes on. The Marlies have used 5 different goaltenders, and none of them have hit that mark. So it has been a weird year for goaltenders in that division or in that team. But I think what the Marlies need to hope for is that all the other teams basically destroy each other And then whatever teams they have to face to try to make it to the Calder Cup Finals, they basically all run out of gas by the time they get to Toronto, because some of these matchups could be bloodbaths.
I also think, too, that, like, I know that the Maple Leafs brass doesn't have the same approach to the Marlies as, say, like, the Rangers do with Hartford, where it's very clear the Rangers don't care. Like, mm-hmm. this is the first time in which you've seen the Rangers even pretend to care about what happens to Hartford. And some of that, I think, is accidental. Like, it's cap, issues mm-hmm. that they literally are, you know, not able to bring a single dollar in. Whereas the Marlies and the Maple Leafs, like, the Maple Leafs care. They want their players to grow up in better environments with, you know, so they'll bring in good vets. I think this year is an exception, because once we cross the threshold into the postseason, I don't think Kyle Dubas gives one shiny dollar about what happens to the Marlies, because yeah. he knows if the Maple Leafs bow out in the first round,
yeah,
that's the end. So, like, if, you know, there's maybe a question of, do I call Joseph Woll up or not, because Matt Murray, you know, needed a tissue in the morning. 100% yes. not hesitate on that.
Yeah.
So though that would be my concern with Toronto. And yeah, they did do a bunch of, like, cap compliant things at the beginning that maybe inflated some of Toronto's starting roster there, but they've also lost a lot of guys over the season. Like, Nick Robertson
mm-hmm.
Would be super helpful yeah. to at least one Toronto based professional hockey team at this point. So I think I have hope that for Toronto too. It really does, though, it begs the question, like you said, about they, you know, 85% of AHL games are played with two teams in the same division.
Mm-hmm.
So what does Toronto, like, actually look like against a Providence, a Hershey, a mm-hmm. Charlotte, a Springfield? We have basically no idea. They yeah. play one game, and that's not the same in the regular season.
Yeah.
I think one of my bingo squares is that whoever wins the North gets swept by whoever wins the Atlantic in the playoffs. That might still come true.
Yeah.
Because, yes, Joseph Woll has played really well this year, but he also hasn't played a ton. So mm-hmm. to say confidently, like, oh, no, he's definitely the guy, like, he's capable of anchoring that team, I think that – I definitely don't know. it's not like he has a big resume of previous mm-hmm. experience at the professional level yeah. to give me that confidence boost. It's not like it's Trey Grosnick or Dustin Tokarski at the AHL level. I'm like, I know what I'm getting here.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Woll does not have that, you know big or developed resume at the pro level, and that's fine. He's young, but at the same point, it's like, we don't know. Goaltending yeah. is made up. It's basically voodoo. So,
yeah,
I think that is a good place to leave it. Sarah, let's move on. Where are we going next?
We're heading to Cleveland. We're going to take a look at the Cleveland Monsters, where the Outdoor Classic happened. That was a qualified success for the Monsters. The Unexpected Sunshine wasn't a deal breaker, but definitely kind of thinned out the atmosphere there. Regardless, that game on March 4th also marks a point for the Monsters. It is the last time they didn't give up a power play goal. So not a good point. Since then, the Monsters are clocking in at a not very nice 69% on the penalty kill. While the Monsters' PK was trending up in January and February, it is not going well now. So what is wrong, and what can the Monsters do to fix it?
So every time we look at penalty kills, we talk about the same three ways to improve it, because, well, penalty kill, there's only so much you can do to fix a bad penalty kill. The number one way to not give up power play goals is don't take penalties. I know. Sage advice. Who would have ever thought of that? And obviously, every team's going to take penalties. That's the nature of playing hockey. But the Monsters are not doing themselves any favors here. They're 28th on the season in power plays given up. Since the Outdoor Classic, they've given up four or more power plays in every game except for one. And having watched all of those penalties that had been taken that gave the other team a power play in the game since the Outdoor Classic, I think there's only one of them that I was like, okay, are we being serious here? I don't know about that one. The rest of them, I'm like, nope, you did that. Like, some were a little more questionable than others. There was a holding on Jurecek that I'm like, I can see it, but I don't agree with it. It was like one, I think it was cross-checking penalty that they took where I'm like, no, that's a bad call, ref. Like, you made a mistake there. But the Monsters also have the bad habit of taking penalties while already shorthanded. Of the nine, three of the nine power play goals they've given up since March 4th are 5v3. And the majority of the penalties that the Monsters take aren't good ones. They're undisciplined ones that were 100% unnecessary. For example, Brendan Miller getting an extra penalty for mouthing off to the ref in a tied game in the third period against Grand Rapids. Like, look, you disagree with the call and that's fine, but you literally were just begging for an unsportsmanlike on the way to the box, and that almost sank your team in that game. Like, yeah, it didn't work out that way, but you didn't know that when it happened. So the second best way not to give up power play goals is to not let teams enter the offensive zone. Now, obviously, the faceoff at the beginning is in the zone, but the goal is to get it out and to not let that team come back in and set up. And the Monsters' forecheck is a 1-3 forecheck, which is typical. And it's called a 1-3 forecheck because that's what it looks like. And if you're normally a podcast listener, this may be a good time to switch over to the YouTube portion because we're going to do some visual aid parts here. We don't have video like the fancy Hershey segment because I didn't want to kick Sarah out again to make the bandwidth work. But it's called a 1-3 forecheck because that's what it looks like. There's one guy in the middle here who's the first forechecker, and then three that basically line up in the neutral zone and kind of are supposed to defend their blue line and use that as basically a barrier because, you know, the puck has to go in first. Otherwise, it's offside. So the Monsters use the 1-3 forecheck. However, they're not necessarily the best at using the 1-3 forecheck. Their D often give up loose gaps and kind of allow the opposing team to just kind of walk in. And if you don't know what I mean by a loose gap, that's basically the distance between the defenseman's like range, the reach of his stick, and where the puck is as it enters the zone. You ideally want this to be within one stick length as the puck crosses the blue line. You want to be right there putting pressure on them. And as you get further and further back, your ability to restrict them from gaining the zone obviously changes. And it makes it easier for the team entering to kind of get in and set up if you give them all of that space. Here's just one example of many from Marcus Bjork, just basically leaving this gap wide open. Like, there is a stick length plus probably another full stick length to the puck. And now normally, if you don't have back-checking pressure, you kind of have to give them some gap. Otherwise, if you don't get the puck or don't, play the body, that guy's going to walk right past you and you're going to get burned. But because he does have back-checking pressure here, as you can see by this guy right here, he should be having a tighter gap and stepping up to make this play, and just doesn't. And this is not just, it's one example from all those games. This is a common theme throughout the play of the Cleveland Monsters, which is, not great. The first forechecker also in their 1-3 forecheck also tends to over-pursue a bunch. And by over-pursue, I mean he'll go chasing plays kind of like he's TLC chasing waterfalls. You shouldn't do it. Because if you aren't in the neutral zone when you're trying to make that forecheck as the first forechecker, you're not doing the guys behind you any benefit. Because your job as F1, as it's called, forechecker one, forward one, is to steer play to one side or the other. And you can't do that if you're down below the goal line. Here's another screenshot of just one example of many times in which Cleveland's first forechecker is down here trying to make a play on the puck, and there is two Belleville Senators plus Dylan Ferguson in net there to play the puck. You were never coming out of this situation with the puck, and yet you went chasing down here, and Belleville picked it up and just walked through the neutral zone and got his own entry because you over-pursued. This is, again, not a one-off thing that happened. It happens with alarming regularity in the last handful of games in Cleveland's penalty kill. One of the other way to, stop teams from scoring power play goals against you is by what you do in zone and preventing them from, getting quality chances when they do gain the zone. In the zone, the Cleveland Monsters play what's known as the check press system, also known as the wedge plus one or the 1-1-2. But I call it the check press. I feel like it's the coolest name of the three, and that matters. The check press, or wedge plus one, if you really want to get technical, is named that because, well, the wedge plus one is what it looks like. Basically, you have two defensemen who guard the lower slot area, one forward who covers kind of the high slot, and they make a wedge, a triangle. And then you have one other penalty killer who's basically your rover. And they're the one that goes and pursues the puck and pressures whoever has the puck. And this player, the rover, will interchange with the forward at the top of the wedge. So basically, they will try and make up for the lack of that fifth defender with their flexibility to basically, you know, one pressures one side, and if the puck goes, you know, to the other sideboards, one goes and pressures and the other replaces him at the top of the wedge, and so on and so forth. That interchange is vital to penalty killing. And if you screw it up, well, it doesn't go too well. And spoiler, the monsters aren't doing great at that. The other thing, too, is this is not an innovative penalty killing system. Nearly every team in the AHL uses the check press in some version or form. The difference from one team to the other is how aggressive they pursue and how and when they apply pressure. And the monsters are fairly aggressive and decent at applying pressure. What sinks them in zone is their understanding of the system. To play an effective penalty kill in general, regardless of what system you play, you need to know where to be and when. You're not always defending a player. Sometimes you're just defending space. You're defending a passing lane, a shooting lane, even for someone who doesn't have the puck. And every time the puck moves or one of your teammates goes to apply pressure, where, you know, what shooting lane or passing lane you're supposed to cover and what your responsibility is can shift every single time something in this equation moves, whether it's the puck, one of your teammates, etc. That's why penalty killing is exhausting, both mentally and physically. And the Monsters PKers are, by and large, not great at this. They've been late to interchanges before. In this screenshot, basically what happened here is the guy circled in red was the rover and was pressuring along the far wall here. The puck came to the top of the point, and he went to interchange with the top with the other forward. The other forward comes out the pressure, and he took his good, sweet time recovering through that, where he needed to skate hard. Because as soon as this puck came over to Taro Hirose on Grand Rapids here, as you can see, he's got nothing but green grass here. There is all this space and no one to cover, and he walks in a tie game with a minute and 43 left in regulation and gets a high danger chance. Now, the Monsters make the save in this particular instance, but this very easily could have been the game-winning goal, and the Monsters would have gotten then 0 points out of it, all because of one kind of lazy effort here in recovering and getting into the place you're supposed to be across the ice. Those moments matter. The other thing, too, is there is a lot of puck movement on good power plays, and defending them means that you have to kind of understand when things shift around, where you're supposed to be and where you're supposed to go. Here's another good example of the Monsters just not doing that. Again, against Grand Rapids here, where you have the puck down here, this little green dot. It's right by the bottom of the net, and you have good defensive pressure on it here, but these two penalty killers are guarding no one. They're not protecting the pass. They're not between the puck and this passing lane to this Monsters player. They're not between the puck and this passing lane into this Monsters player. And that means that is two guys of your four guys on the ice not doing their job. This pass goes right through the slot here, goes to this Grand Rapids player, and he gets a quality scoring chance because of it. That's not a good look for you guys. If I had to say, you know, one of the other kind of considerations here for penalty kills too that we don't talk about often is personnel, mostly because just about anyone can be coached to penalty kill well. Sometimes there are guys that specifically after seeing them time and time again just not seem like they're getting it, that we will advocate like, please stop putting this guy on the penalty kill. In Bridgeport, that guy is Jeff Kubiak. In Cleveland, that guy is Marcus Bjork. He is the patient zero of all of the things that we've talked about that the Monsters are doing wrong. He is just not good at penalties. Like, he has other attributes to his game that are, you know, useful. Killing penalties is not one of them. Guys like Richards and Christensen are good penalty killers, but when you have one or two guys that aren't on the same page with you, aren't, you know, making reads fast enough, aren't processing what the power play is doing efficiently, it sinks you because there's only four of you out there, and having 25% of you being not on the same page is not good enough. All in all, the problem with the Monsters PK isn't the systems. It's the execution. It's the understanding of when to press, when to back off, and most importantly, knowing what or where your assignment is and then going and doing that as quick as possible. That's what's making the Monsters PK just not getting it done.
All right, so really quickly, the Monsters are currently favored by the model to make the playoffs. According to the model, they're a 72.8% chance to make it in. That being said, do you think they get in, and can they go on a run?
I think they get in. They're 2 points back with three games at hand as of Thursday night. That's not just controlling your destiny. That's basically needing to not botch it, especially considering that they play Belleville twice and one more time against Laval. Those are the teams that are basically right in the mix there with them. If they don't make it, they will literally only have themselves to blame. As for going on a playoff run, assuming they play Rochester in the first round, because at this point that seems the most likely scenario, I think they're an underdog in that series. They might not even get a home game out of it, depending on how we're deciding to structure things this year, because like Atlantic teams got home playoff games in the best of three first round. I think everyone else did not. And that doesn't make any sense, but hey, it's the AHL. Making sense is like an accident at times. So if they don't get a home game out of it, I think they're a sizable underdog, not a massive one, but like they're probably 40%, if I had to guess, is where I would peg their chances to beat Rochester in a best of three playoff series. But 40% is absolutely doable. Like if it's 40% to rain that day and it doesn't, that happens all the time. But Rochester has been a team that struggled to find consistency this season and overall has good puck movers on the blue line and some quality forwards, but they lack depth and don't defend well. Neither of their special teams are impressive. And while, yeah, Cleveland's an underdog in that series, but not a massive one. I definitely think they have the capability of, you know, stealing that series from Rochester on the road. A run further than that first round matchup against the four seed? At this point, that seems unlikely. Their PK, as we just detailed, is not good. They don't defend terribly well 5-on-5. I don't like any of the goalies available to them. And while normally that would include John Gillies, A, I think he's still injured, and B, he has not been good this season, and C, the environment he's stepping into is also not going to help him. Cole Sillinger got papered down, but from my reading of how papering down and all of the roster moves is supposed to function, he's the only one. That means not a lot of other reinforcements are coming for Cleveland when Columbus inevitably does not make the playoffs. But that means no Kirill Marchenko and a lot of the other guys they could have sent down on without waivers and didn't. I don't think based on the horses they have in Cleveland right now or are going to have available to them in the playoffs, I don't think that's enough to topple Utica or Syracuse or Toronto as it stands right now. Should injuries happen and Utica has to play, you know, Poulter or who's their goalie they just got that's also not very good? Mittens, I think maybe. Yeah, like there. If that happens, we can talk. Then they have a live shot at it if we're going to play, you know, goalie carousel with some of these teams. But right now, I don't see them making it past the second round. I think they could beat Rochester, but I think Rochester's probably a reasonable favorite. But I don't think they have the horses to compete with the top of the North Division. So I'm going to say it's not impossible. Hockey's full of goofy bounces and stuff like that, but very, very unlikely that they make it outside the second round. Sarah, any closing thoughts on Cleveland before we had to break here?
I'm just thinking about that, like, incredibly mediocre penalty kill going up against what I have seen from the Marlies on their power play. And I think that tells me all I need to know about what would happen if those two teams happened to meet up. Stop taking penalties, Cleveland, please.
I mean, on the bright side for Cleveland in the playoffs is penalties don't get called as often.
Yeah.
But on the downside for Cleveland in the playoffs, their power play is part of their, you know, lifeblood for winning games. So if penalties aren't getting called as often, that both works in their favor and against them. Yeah. So, all right. We're going to take a break here. After the break, we will get to Chicago, Iowa, Ontario, and Tucson. If you're just here for the Eastern Conference or just here for Cleveland, this is your jumping off point. Thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, leave us reviews. We would really appreciate that. Also, check us out on social media. Links to our social media and more can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We will be right back. Stay tuned. And we're back from break. Thank you for listening to those ads, which you definitely did. You didn't press fast forward at all, and I appreciate that. Let's move to the Central Division and talk about, Sarah, the Chicago Wolves, the place where you are. Mm-hmm. The Wolves were briefly within sight of a playoff spot, especially as some teams above them struggled, and they, you know, put in some W's. Let's not discredit that. But the gap is widened as of right now. The model has them with just a 24% chance to make the playoffs. Still, there have been some positives, including a penalty kill that's currently second in the league, a thing that I feel like has flown under the radar, especially by us a lot. Maybe in the future we'll talk about it. But what's been working for the Wolves lately? Where have they had trouble, and what can they look forward to?
So good things for the Wolves, and it's been a consistent story, especially since like the start of the year, is that more and more players have been coming back from injury. Ryan Dzingel finally came back. He scored in his first game back. He's only played three games. They held him out of the middle of a 3-3. But even just in terms of his impact in the room with, you know, being a presence there has already been something that I think a lot of guys have appreciated. Mackenzie McEachern has been back since February. He's got 15 points in 19 games, five multi-point games. He's a player who's always been a little bit streaky, but he has made an immediate impact on the roster as well, both on the ice and in the room. In addition, there have been earlier returns in the year from guys like Ryan Suzuki, Kevin Fitzgerald, who really helped kind of fill out that roster and move some of those ECHL guys out. There have been some small tweaks at the trade deadline to bring on some more experienced players and move out guys who weren't working, move out some ECHL guys. Zach Snishin, 4 points in 13 games, which is actually a slightly better pace than he was on while he was with Utica. They also got Jack Dugan, who exists. And, you know, so it's, again, these moves that are helping put players back in roles that they're supposed to be in. You know, a guy who's a first-year AHLer probably shouldn't be your top-line forward. A guy who's an ECHLer probably shouldn't be your number one center. And moving some of these guys around have been able to put people back in the correct roles. The penalty kill, that is something that, like we said, has really gone under the radar. They've struggled with it at times, but it's currently number two in the league. The net PK has them ranked first in the league. And this is despite the goaltending struggles that they've had, despite the kind of weak defense that they have had, for some reason, the penalty kill is working for them. And it's not like they don't take a lot of penalties. You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I certainly watch a lot of Wolves games and I'm like, you're always in the box, aren't you? You sure are. And so seeing that penalty kill be good, and seeing guys like, you know, Ryan Suzuki, putting it out there, you know, blocking shots. Max Lajoie has been really important on the penalty kill. There was a recent game that they just lost, you know, 6-1 or something. And it's, you know, late in the third period. There's no chance the Wolves are coming back into the game. And Lajoie is still out there blocking shots. So, you know, there are players who are still, you know, putting it all in there for this penalty kill. And it's working. Those are good things. Bad things. Jack Drury gone back up to the NHL. He had 24 points in 37 games with the Wolves. He really helped solidify that center position for the team. No one really even expected him to be in the AHL this year. Everyone thought that he was going to stick in the NHL. That didn't really happen. He is back up there now. He scored the game winner like in his first game back up. So, you know, great for him. Probably won't ever see him again. But, you know, losing him has weakened that center position for the team. But the biggest like blow to the Wolves has been Pyotr Kochetkov getting called back up to the NHL. It is no coincidence that the Wolves kind of started making their way back up the standings and inching a little closer to maybe jumping in the playoffs whenever Kochetkov got back reassigned to the AHL when Carolina's goalies were healthy again. And it is no surprise that they have now kind of nosedived now that he is gone. Zach Sawchenko is fine as a backup, but we've seen what happens when you rely on him for the bulk of your starts. It's not good. We have been spared more of the Cale Morris experience, but instead may have single-handedly ruined any chance that young Jacob Kucharski had at a professional career. He is a player who signed an amateur tryout agreement after finishing his college career at University of Nebraska, Omaha. And one of those deals that, you know, like any guy who gets an ATO at this point, give him a look, see how he does. You know, maybe the Hurricanes don't want to sign him in the future, but at least it's going to get him exposure at this level, see if anything else materializes. All in all, totally normal move. All teams in this league, you see random guys showing up after their college careers end and play a couple games. Fine. He had a relatively undistinguished NCAA career, and before that, a pretty unremarkable USHL tenure. He bounced around a little bit in colleges. He was a seventh round draft pick in 2018. And, you know, so he got signed to this deal. They played him in the middle game of the 3-3. He played just over 13 minutes. He lasted for 13 minutes in this game against Manitoba. He allowed 4 goals on 8 shots, including goals on the first 2 shots that he faced. Yeah, it was ugly. The first goal against, like, honestly, not necessarily cause for alarm. When Kochetkov joined the team last year, he so routinely allowed goals on the first shot that he faced that it kind of became a joke on Wolves Twitter, to the point where when he got called up to the NHL, everyone was like, don't worry, Hurricanes, if he gives up a goal on the first shot, like, it'll be fine. Like, you know, but things didn't get better from there because then he allowed a goal on the second shot. And it just got progressively worse. Now, it's not all his fault. The team overall was playing like they still had an NHL caliber goalie in net rather than a kid facing his first ever professional action. The play was very sloppy. Lots of odd man rushes, lots of breakaways, turnovers. Like, you name the thing wrong that they could have done, and in that 13 minutes and some seconds, the Wolves did it. So, you know, not great, but still, the team knew who they had in net behind them. So I do place responsibility on them for not playing the right way in front of this kid who was making his professional debut after playing, honestly, fairly little in college. It looked like I was watching the October Wolves, not the Wolves that had been stringing together some wins. So that was it was a pretty frustrating game to watch. And you had to feel bad for the kid because that is not... You know, he's already coming into a team that is not making the playoffs, and then to have them just completely blow it in front of him had to feel kind of crummy. Overall, the gap between the Wolves and Rockford, who's also kind of taken a tumble of their own recently, it's pretty much insurmountable at this point. For anyone who's hoping for some kind of miracle run, Rockford was at 67 points, Chicago was at 58. So, like, it's going to take a lot for something like that to change. The Wolves on Wednesday night had just an epic collapse against Grand Rapids, which probably sealed the deal for them. That actually bounced Grand Rapids back ahead of them in the standings. The Wolves had a 2-0 lead going into the third period, and then just a complete collapse where they allowed 6 goals against, including 4 straight, all in the third period. Jamison Rees did tie it up for a second. That was fun, and then it all went downhill from there. So if you were hoping for a playoff run, it is probably time to start gently making some other plans and focusing on some things to look forward to in the closing weeks of the season. The penalty kill is great. Like, that is honestly something to be happy about. We see excellent teams all the time just have absolute garbage penalty kills. You know, having a good penalty kill doesn't mean, like, I mean, you know, great teams, bad penalty kills. It happens. But seeing the Wolves be able to put this together and having those players like Max Lajoie putting, you know, blocking shots with the body in a meaningless game, like that's something to be proud of, honestly. So be happy about that. As we're watching these final weeks of the season, you want to watch to see if those bad habits creep back in. We saw it in that game against Manitoba where they completely failed their young goaltender. And you want to not see that happen. There has been a lot of progress of young players, and that's something to keep an eye on as we continue. Guys like Jamison Rees, Ryan Suzuki, Vasily Ponomarev, Antony Honka. Those are all young guys who have taken strides and who are better players today than they were at game one. And that's something that does have a lot of meaning for this team and for these guys who all want to eventually make it to the NHL. Overall, when you watch them, you know, this one game, this one lazy period against Grand Rapids aside that sort of lost them the game, for the most part, this isn't a team that has quit. There are issues with lack of urgency. We've seen that with them kind of throughout the season, saw it in that Grand Rapids game, saw it in that Manitoba game. But there's a difference between that lack of urgency and just the body language of I've given up. And I don't see that from the Wolves when I watch them. They're still a team that fights. They play to the end, but they have some bad habits that they've struggled to overcome. And at this point, it's too late. It's too late to fix them.
I do want to say one thing that is going to get everyone who's a Wolves fan to hate the current standing system that we have. Sarah, would you like to know how many times the Rockford Ice Hogs have won a game in regulation this season?
Oh, it's not a lot, I don't think. Yeah.
Of their 30 wins this season, how many do you think Rockford has had of those 30 wins in regulation?
I'm going to give them half. I'm going to give them 15.
15 is correct. They have been to overtime or and beyond 24 times this season. Chicago has been beyond the third period eight times. Chicago's 24 regulation wins. That's 9 more than Rockford. 9.
I hate this knowledge.
So like that 3-2-1 point system that people mm-hmm. want, or me who just doesn't want loser points, mm-hmm. that takes what is now like the season's over and turns it into a manageable gap where I remember, mm-hmm. if I remember the math correctly, if you got rid of all the loser points, period, across the league, Chicago would be 6 points back of Rockford. Like, yeah. Is that a great spot for them to be in? No, but at least that's a manageable piece. Mm-hmm. They've been to overtime 24 times. That's the most. Nobody else in the league is even at 20.
That's and amazing.
That, like, look, Chicago isn't going to make the playoffs for a big, like, a laundry list of reasons.
Yeah.
But Rockford basically getting to overtime 24 times this season is one of them. And that's absurd.
No, I hate that.
All right. I think that's a good place to leave it now that we've enraged every Wolves fan. Sarah, where are we going next?
We're heading to Iowa, where we're going to look at the Iowa Wild. Yep, you're representing there. The Minnesota Wild have recalled Sammy Walker on the 9th. He was Iowa's leading scorer by 4 points. The Wild have gone 4-2 in the 6 games since then. They've only lost to Coachella Valley, which is the second best team in the AHL. So how has Iowa managed this?
Well, Nick Batan and Marco Rossi have been red hot recently. The Wild as a team have scored 21 goals since Walker was called up. Sarah, how many of those 21 goals do you think Rossi or Batan have been involved in? Either scored the goal or have an assist on of the 21?
Well, I know Rossi has been, like, pun intended, wild. So we're going to go with, like, I feel like it's the vast majority, like 17 or something.
14 of 21 have been either scored by or assisted by Rossi or Patan. That's literally 2/3 of all of the team's goals have them as an active part of the play in some way. And having looked at those goals, most of them are primary points on them. Like there's only one or two in which it's a second assist or something like that. And that's not to say that this, you know, little stretch of 4-2 in the six games without what was their leading scorer has been smooth sailing the entire way. That's not true. The first period of Tuesday's game against San Diego was kind of a burn the tape period. But Iowa regrouped in the first intermission and battled back. The second and third period of Saturday's game against San Diego also weren't exactly what the Wild had in mind, but they managed to batten down the hatches and hold on. That Friday game in Coachella Valley, I would argue they were the better team through two periods, and they showed good things in Wednesday's game in moments, in places, in periods. This is a team, though, that has some moxie to it. They have some fight to it. They don't just pack it in when they're behind. They have five wins this season going into the third period losing. Only Charlotte, Providence, Rockford, and Milwaukee have more this season. And as we just talked about, all of Rockford's wins losing in the third period were basically in overtime. So thanks, loser point system. And we've talked about this before. I don't think much of Tim Army as a hockey coach, but I will give him credit where it's due. No team he's ever coached has had quit in them. When the chips are down, they, you know, put their backs against the wall and they fight. And this one is no different. And we've seen that on this run. Sammy Walker gets called up and they find ways to battle it out and pull to wins. And they've done so not going with the good old fashioned Tim Army tried and true playbook of punch guys in the face unsuspectingly when doing it. Also, to be at least moderately fair to the Iowa Wild at this point, they are on a moderate PDO run. And we'll pull the chart up here for everyone. If you're not familiar with PDO, PDO is a measure of puck luck. And you want to be at right around where this gray line is running across. That's 100. And the Iowa Wild are currently 103.54. And the point is if you're a point or two above or a point or two below, you are getting unsustainably good puck luck or unsustainably bad puck luck. And that's going to go in the other direction. As you can see over the course of the season, that's pretty much how it's worked for Iowa. They get too far away or too, you know, in either direction, and it bounces back and forth. And that's true of every team in the AHL, save for like one or two that have basically just been north most of the season. But Iowa is currently at 103.54. Now it's coming down, so that at least kind of gives me some idea that like this is justifiable. Puck luck is a finicky thing though, so I wouldn't go out seeking black cats or, you know, have Drake wear your jersey or something like that. But I do think that the fact that they've managed to battle this well, that they've had a lot of resilience in these games, and they've got a little lucky on the side, I think that spells good things for a team that's missing one of its brightest and best players.
All right, so Iowa is safely in a playoff spot right now, and they appear to be locked into a first-round series against Rockford at this point. It's unlikely the Wild catch Manitoba, unlikely the Wolves make the playoffs. So how important is this final stretch of the season for the Wild to gain home ice advantage, and how do you like the Wild's chances against Rockford in a best-of-three series?
So home ice is always huge in the playoffs, especially in these early games where it doesn't seem like the AHL is too keen on letting the bottom seed have home games, which makes me wonder what the whole point is, but whatever. Yes, it's a factor in the regular home ice is a factor in the regular season, but it's much, much bigger in the playoffs. To illustrate that, in the 21-22 regular season, home teams won 54.7% of the games played. In the 2021-22 playoffs, home teams won 62.8% of the games played. Teams with home ice advantage won 5 of 7 first-round playoff matchups last season. So yes, the fact that the Wild are basically locked into a matchup with Rockford, that extra push for home ice advantage absolutely matters, and it matters a lot. Especially as last season, those bottom seed teams in the Western Conference weren't given a home playoff game, so it's not like if you won one on the road, you could at least get one home game and that could help balance things out for you. It doesn't look like the AHL is too keen on that again. So assuming that bit of idiocy continues into this season, if Iowa falls to that 5 seed, they won't get a home game in the playoffs against Rockford, even if it goes to a 3rd game. In terms of how they match up against Rockford, again, obviously home ice matters, but let's throw that out the window for right now because we don't know how that's going to wrap up the season. Let's assume a neutral site, empty stadium. And here the team's 2 points apart in the standings. Rockford has 2 games in hand, so either team could get home ice. So, again, neutral site, empty rink. I still think it's difficult to call. Rockford's parent club, Chicago, isn't making the playoffs. Minnesota clearly is. I think that's an advantage for Rockford because they're going to get reinforcements and not be, you know, someone has a hangnail on the NHL roster. Bye-bye, Marco Rossi. Like, they're... Chicago is going to load up Rockford the best they can. Rockford also hasn't had stable goaltending basically all season. As we talked about in our last episode, a lot of that is on their abysmally bad net front defense. Jesper Wallstedt has really come into his own late in the season. Since the calendar turned to 2023, he has a .924 save percentage, which that's pretty good. Arvid Soderblom and Anton Khudobin both have playoff experience under their belts, whereas Wallstedt, I believe, is like, what, 20 years old and a rookie? Does that matter? I don't think it does, but it. Some people think that playoff experience and having the bright lights on you changes things. I don't think so, but even still, Wallstedt has been the more reliable goaltender this season and has the better defensive structure in front of him. Advantage Iowa. I like Rockford's offensive depth more, but Iowa's defense much more. So I think that's, or I like Rockford's offense more, but I like Iowa's defense more. I think that probably balances out somewhere in the middle. We'll call that a push. I think Anders Sorensen is a better coach than Tim Army, so that's a plus on the Rockford side for me. All in all, I think Iowa is a tiny bit better, all things considered, like 51-52% favorite on neutral ice, empty stadium. But home ice advantage is going to be a thing that happens here, and I think it's going to play a big role in who's the favorite. Iowa can win the series no matter if they're home or on the road, but obviously, you know, you want to stack the deck in the biggest way possible that you can. And home ice advantage is going to be the thing that swings that deck one way or the other. All right, I think that is a good place to leave it. Let us go talk about the Ontario Reign.
All right, so February 25th, the Reign were 30-21. They were tied for third in the Pacific Division. One 10-game losing streak later, and Bakersfield is firmly in their rearview mirror for fifth place in the division. The Reign finally ended the suffering with a win over Tucson. But Sean, I had to know your thoughts on the Ontario Reign and what exactly the hell happened with them.
Well, first of all, yes, the Reign are definitely seeing Bakersfield in the rearview mirror. That's not a question at this point. But I also want to preface this by saying I'm not even going to pretend like I've watched all 11 of those games, the 10 they lost plus the shutout win over Tucson the other night. I've seen 3 in total beginning to end, parts of about 5, and highlights of probably 2 or 3 of the rest. So I'm not going to claim that I have the entire picture over that entire 11 games of what's happened. But, you know, since you asked me, I'll tell you what I think. I still, you know, do AHL analysis on the side here. I do have some answers. First and foremost, this team misses Jordan Spence so incredibly badly, because apparently he was the only defenseman left on this roster who could do anything of value in transition on either side of the puck. The Ontario Reign blue line, in terms of their ability to execute breakouts, defend rush chances, field dump-ins, beat forechecking pressure, like the value of those collective abilities of transition and important tasks for defensemen isn't zero. But it's a number that rounds to zero, apparently. Helge Grans, Cameron Gaunce, Jacob Muvirara just seem to suddenly not be able to pressure a rush chance, force a dump-in, recover said dump-in, and complete a pass that goes up the ice for more than 3 times a game combined amongst the 3 of them. Not shockingly, that their transition game has fallen to pieces and they're having bad results. One of the surefire ways in which you can screw up a good team is to screw up their ability to get from their defensive zone into the offensive zone. Like, people really underrate how important that is. And it's massive, as you can see from Ontario screwing it up badly and losing 10 straight. Second thing, and this isn't just a defenseman thing, it's every guy on the team has been guilty of this in some place, some more than others, but that's puck and threat management. I have lost count of how many horrible turnovers led directly to odd man rushes and goals against, or how many times I've seen 3+ Rain players get caught miles behind the puck in an obvious moment where play is going the other way, and there's another odd man rush going the other way. Third, does anyone want to defend Royal Road or the net front? Anyone? Bueller? Anyone? And if you're not familiar with the term Royal Road, go check out our episode 0 where we talk about the importance of Royal Road, but in very brief condensed form, if you draw a line dividing the offensive zone in half from basically the middle of the goal going towards the center ice dot, that line is called Royal Road. And any shot that comes off a pass directly across from there, so like you catch the pass and a second later you put the shot on net, the chances of that shot going in and becoming a goal go up exponentially, because getting goalies to move side to side and then facing a shot is a surefire way to jack up your chances of scoring on that shot, because they're having to move, they can't see where the shooter is, and they have to get set very quickly. That shoots up your chances. So defending Royal Road and defending, obviously, the front of the net is super crucial to playing sound defense. And the Rain don't do that right now. I've also lost count of the number of goals and scoring chances that happened where someone is literally just wide open on the back door or across Royal Road, and there isn't a single Rain player within 10 feet of them, and a pass comes to them or the puck comes to them on a rebound, and it's just tapping. Like San Jose scored one off a Royal Road pass that went from the point all the way to the back post, Andrew Agazino, and he just taps it in. And I'm like, that shouldn't happen. Like, that just shouldn't happen in like a that's bad defense. Like, that's bad defense to an embarrassing level. Like, nobody should be standing that far, you know, untouched and have a pass go that far a distance across Royal Road into the back of the net. Like, fourth, I would be absolutely remiss if I didn't talk about puck luck here. Puck luck is obviously a part of hockey. Hockey is a sport that is, you know, in some way influenced by the luck that happens on the ice. The Rain's current 2-week rolling PDO is 87.3. It is the third lowest mark of any team this season by my tracking. It looks like this. For those who are unfamiliar with PDO, again, episode 0 of our podcast will help explain that. But in short, PDO is a measure of puck luck, and 100 is the normal target goal you're trying to reach. Get more than a point or two away from 100, either up or down, and it's likely that you're getting good luck or bad luck, and it's not going to stay that way. As you can see from previous trips, the Rain have bounced around a little bit, and anytime they've kind of gotten too far from the line, they go back. And that's not just true of the Rain. That's true of, oh, I don't know, pick a team this season. There's Springfield, Providence. Oh, that's not what I meant to do. Lehigh Valley, Grand Rapids. The crazier ones are like San Jose or San Diego, where it's just bouncy, bouncy, bouncy. But a lot of teams have been pretty consistently around that line. And when they stray too far from it, they go back. The Rain being all the way down here, like, this is going to go back the other way. It's not possible for a team to have that bad of puck luck. San Jose, the only team who's hit the mark, as soon as they hit that, right back up. Like, this is going to get better, guys. Lastly, let's talk about goaltending. No. Cal Peterson, who started 9 of these 11 games, has not played particularly well. It would be nice if he could stop even 70% of the high danger scoring chances he faces a night. I don't think we don't track high danger scoring save percentage or anything like that, unfortunately. But if he could stop 70% of them, I think that would probably be an improvement. But I think it's pretty likely at this point that Cal Peterson does not trust the defense in front of him to do their jobs, so he can sit and focus on doing his and not try and anticipate where breakdowns are going to happen and cheating to that place. And honestly, I very much don't blame him for not trusting the defense in front of him after we've talked about how bad the defense in front of him has been. And given the absolute number of just breakdowns that are happening in front of him on a nightly basis, I just assume between periods he looks like the Ben Affleck smoking a cigarette meme. Because all the goals I've seen scored against him on this run, and again, I haven't seen all the games. I have not seen all, I think it's 30 goals that he's given up in the 9 games he started. Of the ones I've seen, I think I'd say maybe 3 or 4 are ones that were genuinely on him. Like, I think San Jose scored one off the faceoff that was on him. There was one that was a shot against Abbotsford that was like from the corner on a rush chance. That one's on him. He should have had that one. And the Jet Wu backhand, I feel like he should have probably had that one. Like, yeah, it's a partial breakaway, but it's Jet Wu on his backhand. And like, you knew he was going to shoot. That one I'll put on you. And Villalta started 2 of those games and he hasn't been great either. The goaltending here, just, it hasn't been great. It hasn't. It deserves some of the blame for what's gone wrong, but it sure ain't the majority of the blame based on what I've seen. It's maybe 30% of it. Transition failures, puck management, defending Royal Road in the net front. That's a much bigger piece of why this team is flailing right now than the goaltending. And all of those things influence the goaltending being bad. In terms of playoff chances, unless they basically lose out the rest of the season, which suddenly feels less impossible than it did, say, 2 weeks ago, they're still going to make it. The model, which has the Reigns current roster strength rated as a D on the grade school A to F scale, still has them as a 99.1% chance to make the playoffs. But LA is making the playoffs too. And there's a very reasonable chance that Jordan Spence and other reinforcements never show up. And that should scare the Reign fan base right now, because what's broken right now isn't likely to be fixed overnight with a couple of coaching and video meetings. Because I just assume that Marco Sturm is pointing out the same things on film that I see to them, where it's like, what were you thinking right here when you turned the puck over at our blue line with 2 of your teammates 10 feet below? Like, what was your, like, I imagine he also sees those problems. And some of that is a talent issue. Like, they are not at full strength right now, even given who's in the town. Putting guys like Tyler Inamoto in your top pair is going to go poorly for you. The puck luck will get better. No one is that unlucky for this long. But the other problems we're talking about here, well, those aren't as easy to fix. And the hopes for the Reign in the second round, not looking great right now. Like, if they matched up against Tucson or San Jose today, they're probably a favorite in that series, depending on what, you know, those rosters get back, because neither Tucson nor San Jose's parent club is making the playoffs. So they're going to get reinforcements and Ontario's not. So I think they're probably a favorite with home ice advantage in that series, but not a big one. So their chances of getting, you know, upset in the first round are good. So then if they do get past one of those teams, they have to play like a good team, or at least a reasonably good team. And that's probably not going to go well unless LA gets bounced. So in terms of playoff hopes here, yeah, this definitely hurts them a lot. It definitely shakes a lot of what I thought this team was going to be able to do down, and a lot of that to me is because Jordan Spence isn't there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know Jordan Spence, I think there's a possibility he comes back, you know, sooner. He was largely caught up because Sean Durzi was hurt. And I know Durzi's back, like, practicing, and I think he's nearing a return. So there is a world in which Jordan Spence gets returned to the Reign and becomes once again their only goal or their only defenseman who can move the puck. But yeah, that is a stark difference without him back there to make things happen. Cause yeah, apparently everyone else forgot how to do it.
Yeah, that's been the biggest surprise. Is like, I know Jordan Spence was clearly one of their best defensemen, especially in transition. But like, I was like, oh, he's gone and that's bad and they're going to not be as good for it. But it was like, they still have like Cameron Gaunce last year showed me that he could defy Father Time for at least one more season. And this year I'm like, no, I think he might have caught him.
Yep.
But like Jacob Muvirar, how he grabs him, like where is your ability to do anything? Yeah. Pray to Saint Anthony, I guess, if you're into that kind of thing. I don't know, because it's definitely missing.
Yeah.
All right, I think we've made the Ontario liquor stores rich enough. Let's move on, Sarah. We are going to go to the team that extended and then lost the Reigns losing streak, the Tucson Roadrunners. Tucson is currently holding on to the last playoff spot in the Pacific. But the San Jose Barracuda are hot on their heels in a very loose sense of what hot means. But what do the Roadrunners need to do to keep ahead of the Cuda and punch their ticket to the postseason?
All right. For the Roadrunners, a lot is going to hinge on goaltender Tyler Parks. And if that sounds insane, welcome to the AHL. Arizona called up Ivan Prosvetov on March 9th. And said pretty openly that they don't plan on reassigning him to the AHL for the rest of the NHL regular season. So Arizona is running with three goalies, and that's great for Prosvetov, who's always been looking pretty good with a Tucson team that's often pretty underwhelming. The last five games before he was recalled, there were three wins and two overtime losses, but the organization basically has no depth behind him. John Gillies obviously got traded to the Blue Jackets organization. Tyler Parks has been the backup since then. If you've never heard of him, he is a 30-year-old journeyman, stops in the SPHL, ECHL, Slovakia, and the German leagues. Last year, he played most of the season in the ECHL in Atlanta, which is also where he spent this year. But he has been very strong for the Roadrunners right now. In March, he's got three wins, and I think it's probably going to be three losses now that they lost to the Reign. But those wins were great. In wins, he didn't allow any more than two goals. The two losses that I looked at when I was writing up my notes, he five goals against and four goals against, respectively. So on the whole, it's about what you would expect from a guy who is a mostly career ECHL-level goaltender. Comes in, gets you a few wins, has a couple of ugly games, keeps it together until like the real goaltenders come back. But behind Tyler Parks is David Tendek, who has a total of five AHL games to his resume in his career. He has otherwise been fairly average in the ECHL. So the huge key for Tucson is that Tyler Parks is going to basically play every game possible and is going to need to play out of his mind down the stretch until April 14th, which is when the Coyotes will officially be done with the season and they can return Prosvetov to the AHL to help out the Roadrunners. So goaltending is going to be huge for them as they go down the rest of the season. This is a team that they have scoring. They have Michael Carconi back in the lineup. They have JSD in the lineup. He's got 45 points in 57 games. Michael Kesselring has 2 points in three games since coming over in that trade. But if they can't keep pucks out of the net, they had a 5-3 loss to Milwaukee recently. They surged back from a 3-0 deficit only to allow the game-winning goal with 12 seconds left. If they have more games like that, that is not going to be good news for the Roadrunners. Their upcoming schedule through the rest of the season, they play Colorado twice, San Diego once, Bakersfield twice, Henderson once, twice against Texas, and then twice against the Barracuda. That's not great, honestly. Like, San Diego and Henderson should be pretty easy wins, maybe. Colorado and Texas are both going to be tougher. Bakersfield has 6 wins in their last 10. Barracuda have 5 of their last 10. So those Barracuda games, though, are going to be crucial, given that they are the ones closest to closing that gap between Tucson. The last two Roadrunners games of the season are at home against the Barracuda. So there is the potential for those last two games to be very spicy and to determine who gets that final spot in the Pacific. So if you love drama, you might want to watch those games. But really, so much for Tucson is going to come down to, can this tandem of largely ECHL career goaltenders hold it together long enough for Ivan Prosvitov to come back. If they can, great. If they can't, the San Jose Barracuda would like to say hello.
I am hoping so hard that the last two games of the season do come down to basically a winner take all for the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be so incredibly fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we haven't had that kind of playoff drama in the AHL in years, yeah. I don't think. Like, even last year when Toronto blew it, mm-hmm. like that last game they played against Belleville, like yeah. they had already lost. When they didn't beat Laval in overtime, that was it. Belleville had punched their ticket no matter what happened. It was just a matter of, like, could Belleville move up and get home ice advantage over Rochester at that point? That was it. That was the only question. So, like, we haven't had that last game of the season kind of drama in quite a while. So I'm hoping for it because it's fun.
Yeah, yeah.
That being said, I was like, wait a minute. Tyler Parks, wasn't he, like, a prospect for Calgary at one point? No, that's Tyler Parsons, Sean. David Tendek was, though, at least at one point considered a possible, like, he could be somebody at the NHL level. And then, no. It never panned out. But to say that, like, goaltending is voodoo, as we always say. Could either of them get hot and decide that they were going to, you know, to lock it down? I mean, Tyler Parks is a big dude. He's 6'6", 198. Mm-hmm. David Tendek, on the other side of things, 6'1", 172. So a very different goalie and very likely different goalie style in net for them headed down the stretch. But, yeah, it looks like it's going to be mostly Tyler Giant Parks. So
what's his new
Tyler
name?
National Parks?
Ooh.
I like it. That. Yeah. All right. Sarah, anything to say before we go to Start Bench Ship?
I'm good.
All right. We have some spicy ones today, so let's get to it. If my internet will cooperate with me, which it is not.
Mm-mm.
What are you doing, internet? There we go. All right. Cece, you're going to have to do some editing there. I'm sorry. Sarah, Start Bench Ship. Let's do it.
Yes.
First up, we have coaches on the hot seat. And to be completely clear, you are shipping the coach most likely to get canned.
Okay.
So I will start us off here. I am starting Brent Thompson, despite the fact that Brent Thompson, in my mind, is the one who should most likely should be the one of the three that gets fired. He is going to, like, just do enough this year to be like, well, all right, let's see what happens next year. Like, the team has definitely underperformed again. And I think he's going to just come, like, short of falling on his face that he gets another year. I'm going to bench Manny Viveros because I feel like that first year when Henderson ran up this massive PDO bender and, like, he's put guys into Vegas that have been useful, like Pavel Dorofeev and – oh, the goalie whose name I just lost.
Logan Thompson?
Logan Thompson, thank you. Like, he's put guys into the show that have been useful. So I think he sticks around. Plus, he beat cancer. Like, how do you fire that guy? I'm shipping Ben Simon. Like, this is the second straight year that the Grand Rapids has been, like, embarrassingly bad. And he's not exactly putting dudes into the NHL that, like, he's not developing the prospects and putting them in the NHL in places that you would need in the last couple of years. Like, hi, Joe Valeno. How are you doing? Or Jared McIsaac. Like, those are, like, I think Ben Simon gets the axe of these three. Sarah, what say you?
I'm pretty similar to you. I've swapped a couple, though. I am starting Manny Viveros. Largely for the similar reasons that you mentioned. I think he gets, even if all of Henderson's problems this year were his doing, I think, honestly, you give the man a pass for having dealt with health issues and, like, not even being behind the bench for a chunk of the season. I think he gets another year to right the ship. I'm benching Brent Thompson, similar reasons. Like, I feel like he's done, like, just enough. still, you know, I don't think this show has any faith in Bridgeport to get it together, but he's been adequate. And likewise, shipping Ben Simon, Grand Rapids should be better than they are, you know, especially, you know, adding Alex Nedeljkovic in goal. He has been a good AHL goaltender. He's had some magic at the NHL level, but like he can win a game at this level. And the team in front of him, just like, I feel like we could probably do like highlight reels just of like, why is no one there? Or why are you all over here? It happens all the time in Griffin's games. So they are bad for no good reason. They have the players to be better, and they aren't. So we're shipping him.
Yeah. All right. Next up, changes in affiliation. So to clarify again, you are starting the team that is most likely to change in affiliation in the upcoming offseason. Sarah, I will let you go first.
All right. I'm starting the Springfield Thunderbirds just because I feel like they're always the like team that know, like they're a team that exists. Like I cover this league and I still have to take a hot minute to remember whose affiliate they are at like any given point in time. They're just sort of like the carousel. So like I'm starting them. I'm benching the Wolves just because I have no good reason to believe that they're like, as funny as it would be, I have no good reason to believe that they're going to end their affiliation with the Hurricanes. I fully believe that gets re-signed. Shipping Syracuse, I feel like whatever weird symbiosis they have with the Lightning like works, and they kind of just leave each other alone, and they're it's fine. I feel like they're just always going to be linked together.
All right. I am starting Chicago.
Fair.
I think that like what they're doing is working with Carolina. I'm not in trying to imply that it's not. I think clearly from talking to Don Waddell, or not talking to Don Waddell, Jesus, talking to Wendell Young about his relationship with Don Waddell, it definitely seems solid, and I understand why they came there. But at the same point, their contract is up this year, and it just feels like a Chicago Wolves thing for them to do. I am going to bench the Syracuse. No, I'm going to bench Springfield here. Because St. Louis has been progressively moving their affiliate further and further away from their actual location in St. Louis since they left Peoria. Like, geographically, their affiliate has gotten further away every single time since they left Peoria in, like, 04. And I think it's the funniest thing ever because it's just, so what is further from St. Louis than Springfield? But on a serious note, though, like, yes, I think Springfield is working for them, and Springfield has put a couple of guys, you know, from the development stage into being NHLers, and I think that's good. But at the same point, like many other teams, I think inevitably they're going to realize either A, we're going to continue down this dumb trend of moving them further in like, hello, Maine, or LaPaul, or some idiot thing. Or they're going to realize that like, we should probably do what everyone else is doing and move them closer and set up an AHL franchise in like, Kansas City or Oklahoma City or someplace like that that's nearby but not too close. I'm shipping Syracuse, but I definitely think there is a day coming that they are not Tampa's affiliate. Like, it's not next year. It's probably not the year after that or the year after that. But when Tampa exits its contending window and they decide it's time to tear it down and start over again, that's the moment in which their prospects are going to be front and center of the future of the franchise. Whereas now it's like, oh yeah, we have that Boulay guy. Mm-hmm. That must be nice. Like, it's one day Kucherov and Stamkos and Hedman and Vasilevsky are going to be gone. Mm-hmm. And they're going to need to care a lot more about their AHL affiliate. Not saying that they don't now and they don't have a good relationship, but like, Syracuse at this point could do nothing and develop no one. And Tampa would probably be like, all right, I suppose that's fine. Like, they're not, that's not their big focus. Whereas, you know, if they're, when, you know, 5-10 years from now, when it's time to rebuild again, I think they're going to care. And that's when I think the move gets made. Like, They're definitely the least likely, but I still think at some point that trigger gets pulled. All right. Last one up here. Specialty jerseys. We break this one out every once in a while. We have three interesting ones that have come out recently. So I wanted to talk about them, especially one is a version of the jersey I am wearing. So Sarah, I will start with you. Going back to our usual, just how start bench ship works. What do you think here, Belleville, Iowa, or Syracuse?
All right, I am starting that Iowa jersey. I saw them tweet it the other day, and I was like, this is sick. I don't always love whenever an AHL team is like, haha, let us just imitate what the NHL team did for our whole jersey. But no, this is good. I love the thought that's been put into it. And we don't have the image on here, but like the shoulder patch is this like little angry bird thing. The shoulder patch is just like chef kiss. Like, I love it. I love everything about those Iowa jerseys. I am benching Belleville. I feel like if this Iowa jersey did not exist, I'd probably start it just because it's a big, cool, angry looking bull. That's fun. I am shipping Syracuse because I have a grudge against word mark jerseys in most cases. And I'm not from Syracuse, so I don't even know why it's called the Salt City, but I feel like I'm going to Google that later so that I know for future trivia questions.
I am 100% starting that Iowa. And if you saw my Twitter feed at all at any point, you know, I absolutely campaigning. That should be Iowa's full-time jersey next season. Mm-hmm. I have no notes. Like, that is, yeah, I'm usually against the, like, just adopting whatever your NHL team does. But, like, this fits them so well.
Yeah.
To the point where, spoiler, I actually almost made that logo on my own. Because I was like, I wonder what the outline of Iowa looks like with that kind of wild-like background. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't look good, and that's why they never did it. And when I took my hand at it, it obviously didn't look as good as what is a clear professional design. But, like, I knew that that was the direction they should have gone. Mm-hmm. And, like, they already copy and paste, like, the Minnesota Wilds thing. Basically just scratch out Minnesota and write Iowa on it. So, like, this is a good job of blending your own thing with your NHL club's thing. And I think they should stick to that. The bird on the side is actually their state bird, the Hawkeye. And that's why it's yellow and black. But like this is perfect, and this should be the full-time jersey.
Yeah.
I also am benching Belleville. I don't know how many people still care about the Bulls, or like, I think people are interested and excited and stuff, but I think it's one of those, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that team. They were fun. Mm-hmm. Not like there was a steady, like, slow drumbeat to make this a thing. Like, it also means that Jack Miller is probably going to come back and call those games, and that's a negative thing for Belleville. David Foote is a much better broadcaster. It's very not close. But those jerseys look cool, and not being familiar with the Belleville Bulls, because it's like junior hockey from the mid-90s. Why would I know that? I'm not Jeff Merrick. The jerseys actually look pretty cool. I'm absolutely shipping the Salt City logos. Like, I think, like, the details they put into it and stuff are interesting. Like, I like the cityscape, and like the colors I think look good. My only real thing is, I'm like, does anyone who lives in Syracuse call it the Salt City? Mm-hmm. Like, I know every city has nicknames and stuff like that, but no one knows what they are. Like, no one, like, you know, when people from Charlotte don't tell, like, strangers at a bar in DC, oh yeah, I'm from the Queen City. Mm-hmm. People just look at you like, am I supposed to know what that is? Is there an actual city named Queens? Like, if you walked into a bar in a different state and they're like, oh, where are you from? Like, I'm from the Salt City. People would think you were like Game of Thrones cosplaying them or something. Like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people in Syracuse really do call it that, and that's like a known thing by the population, but I kind of doubt it. Like, the jersey design is cool, but the Salt City part is just the word script logo. I'm like, I don't think people care about that part. The rest of it, I like the details, but I had to find something to decide on here. And that's what I'm sticking to. I don't think people, and like a bunch of other places have done this too. And I'm like, I don't get it. I don't think city nicknames are something that people know or care about. So
no.
Yeah. All right, Sarah, any closing thoughts before we head home here?
I'm ready for the petition to sign to make that Iowa's full-time jersey.
Yes, please.
Bring it on. I'm ready.
Iowa Wild, I know you definitely are listening at this point in the show. That's your full-time jersey next year. If please. You say no, you have screwed up. I'm going to tell you right now, on our background outline for next year, that's going to be what's hanging up there. So your spot, where is Iowa right now on this? I can't even tell. I made this thing and I don't even remember where it is. It's somewhere. Regardless, it's going to be Iowa. Like that's going to be Iowa's one next year. 100%. It's already done. All right.
Yeah. Done.
Sarah, take us home.
That is it for our show today. Thank you so much for watching and or listening. The Calder Farmstead is a part of the Full Press Radio Network. You can listen to this and several other great hockey, sports, and sports entertainment programs all at www.fullpresscoverage.com. Just click the podcast drop-down menu in the top right portion of the website and enjoy.
And if you guys are enjoying the Calder Farmstead, please make sure you subscribe so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Hearing our trade deadline recap 3 weeks later doesn't really do you a whole lot of good. Also, if you are listening to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon, please, 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 please rate and review the podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, like the video, comment what you thought of the episode. Doing so helps others find the show, and your reviews help us improve it. You can also follow the show on social media at Calder Farmstead on Twitter, at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. Links to all of that and more can be found in our link tree, which is at linktr.ee/The Calder Farmstead. Also, by the way, the Iowa item is here. It is a Jerry Mayhew bobblehead. Big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That's AD_DYSFUNCTION, so we can make music for you too. Sarah, where can the people find you?
My name is Sarah Avampato. You can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at Right Said Sarah. It's W-R-I-T-E Said Sarah with an H. You can check out my writing at Full Press Hockey, where I talk about the Ontario Reign, or at Kane's Country, where I talk about the Chicago Wolves. Sean, where can people find you?
I'm Sean O'Brien. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That's SeanO'Brien81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. Both are personal accounts. My Instagram is mostly pictures of my adorable dog, Parker. My Twitter is a mix of everything. It's been a little angrier the past couple days, but in general, it's mostly just observations of the world around me and mostly about hockey. You can find my stats work on Tableau. So all these PDO graphs you see, all of the game predictors, playoff models, all of that fun stuff and more. There's like 30 different graphs that you can go and interact with there. All of that is found on my Tableau page. It's in our link tree for this page. You can also go to bit.ly/data-dump-and-chase, all lowercase, all one word. Thank you, as always, for tuning into the show. For Sarah Avampato, I am Sean O'Brien. Please dump and chase responsibly.